Chapter 139. Amantia Myri, frankness and kindness like Amelia's were likely to touch even such a hardened little reprobate as Becky. She returned Emmy's caresses and kind speeches with something very like gratitude, and an emotion which, if it was not lasting, for a moment was almost genuine. That was a lucky stroke of hers about the child torn from her arms shrieking. It was by that harrowing misfortune that Becky had won her friend back, and it was one of the very first points, we may be certain, upon which our poor simple little Emmy began to talk to her newfound acquaintance. "And so they took your darling child from you," our simpleton cried out. "H. Rebecca, my poor dear suffering friend, I know what it is to lose a boy, and to feel for those who have lost one. But please heaven yours will be restored to you, as a merciful, merciful providence has brought me back mine." "The child, my child?" "Oh, yes, my agonies were frightful," Becky owned, not perhaps without a twinge of conscience. It jarred upon her to be obliged to commence instantly, to tell lies in reply to so much confidence and simplicity. But that is the misfortune of beginning with this kind of forgery. When one fib becomes due, as it were, you must forge another to take up the old acceptance. And so the stock of your lies in circulation inevitably multiplies, and the danger of detection increases every day. "My agonies," Becky continued, "were terrible. I hope she won't sit down on the bottle. When they took him away from me, I thought I should die, but I fortunately had a brain fever, during which my doctor gave me up, and I recovered, and here I am, poor and friendless." "How old is he?" Emmy asked.
11, said Becky.
11, cried the other. "Hi, he was born the same year with Georgie, who is..."
I know,
Becky cried out, who had in fact quite forgotten all about little Rodden's age. "Grief has made me forget so many things, dearest Amelia. I am very much changed. Half wild sometimes. He was 11 when they took him away from me. Bless his sweet face. I have never seen it again. Was he fair or dark?" went on that absurd little Emmy. "How me his hair?" Becky almost laughed at her simplicity. "Ah, today, love some other time, when my trunks arrive from Leipzig, whence I came to this place, and a little drawing of him, which I made in happy days."
"Poor Becky, poor Becky," said Emmy.
How thankful I ought to be, though I doubt whether that practice of piety inculcated upon us by our womankind in early youth, namely, to be thankful because we are better off than somebody else, be a very rational religious exercise."
And then she began to think, as usual, how her son was the handsomest, the best, and the cleverest boy in the whole world. "You will see, my Georgie," was the best thing Emmy could think of to console Becky. If anything could make her comfortable, that would. And so the two women continued talking for an hour or more, during which Becky had the opportunity of giving her new friend a full and complete version of her private history. She showed how her marriage with Rodden Crawley had always been viewed by the family with feelings of the utmost hostility, how her sister-in-law, an artful woman, had poisoned her husband's mind against her, how he had formed odious connections, which had estranged his affections from her, how as he had borne everything poverty, neglect, coldness from the being whom she most loved, and all for the sake of her child, how, finally, and by the most flagrant outrage, as he had been driven into demanding a separation from her husband, when the wretch did not scruple to ask that she should sacrifice her own fair fame, so that he might procure advancement through the means of a very great and powerful but unprincipled man, the Marquis of Stang, indeed, the atrocious monster. This part of her eventful history Becky gave with the utmost feminine delicacy and the most indignant virtue. Forced to fly her husband's roof by this insult, the coward had pursued his revenge by taking her child from her. And thus Becky said she was a wanderer, poor, unprotected, friendless, and wretched. Emmy received this story, which was told at some length, as those persons who are acquainted with her character may imagine that she would. She quivered with indignation at the account of the conduct of the miserable Rodin and the unprincipled Stang. Her eyes made notes of admiration for every one of the sentences in which Becky described the persecutions of her aristocratic relatives, and the falling away of her husband.
Becky did not abuse him. She spoke rather in sorrow than in anger. As he had loved him only too fondly. And was he not the father of her boy?
And as for the separation scene from the child, while Becky was reciting it, Emmy retired altogether behind her pocket handkerchief, so that the consummate little tragedian must have been charmed to see the effect which her performance produced on her audience. Whilst the ladies were carrying on their conversation, Amelia's constant escort, the major, who, of course, did not wish to interrupt their conference, and found himself rather tired of creaking about the narrow stair passage, of which the roof brushed the nap from his hat, descended to the ground floor of the house, and into the great room common to all the frequenters of the Elephant, out of which the stair led. This apartment is always in a fume of smoke and liberally sprinkled with beer. On a dirty table stand scores of corresponding brass candlesticks with tallow candles for the lodgers, whose keys hang up in rows over the candles. Emmy had passed blushing through the room anon, where all sorts of people were collected. Tyrolese glove sellers and Danubian linen merchants, with their packs. Students recruiting themselves with butter broths and meat. Idlers, playing cards or dominoes on the sloppy, beery tables. Tumblers refreshing during the cessation of their performances, in a word, all the fumamans trepidus of a German in unfair time. The waiter brought the major a mug of beer, as a matter of course, and he took out a cigar, and amused himself with that pernicious vegetable, and a newspaper until his charge should come down to claim him. Max and Fritz came presently downstairs, their caps on one side, their spurs jingling, their pipes splendid with coats of arms and full-blown tassels, and they hung up the key of number 90 on the board, and called for the ration of butter broth and beer. The pair sat down by the major, and fell into a conversation, of which he could not help hearing somewhat. It was mainly about Hutches and Hillister, and duels and drinking bouts at the neighboring University of Schopenhausen, from which renowned seat of learning they had just come in the Ilwigen, with Becky, as it appeared, by their side, and in order to be present at the bridal fates at Pumpernickel. The title in Glandarin seems to be en base de gonnaissance, said Max, who knew the French language, to Fritz, his comrade. After the fat grandfather went away, there came a pretty little compatriot. I heard them chattering and whimpering together in the little woman's chamber. We must take the tickets for her concert, Fritz said. Hast thou any money, Max? Bah, said the other, the concert is a concert in Nubibus. Hans said that she advertised one at Leipzig, and the Burschen took many tickets. But she went off without singing. She said in the coach yesterday that her pianist had fallen ill at Dresden. She cannot sing, it is my belief. Her voice is as cracked as thine, O thou beer-soaking renowner. It is cracked. I hear her trying out of her window a Schrecklich English ballad, called The Rose Upon the Balcony. Apostrophe, soften and singen go not together, observed Fritz with the red nose, who evidently preferred the former amusement. Oh, thou shalt take none of her tickets. She won money at the Trent and Quorn last night. I saw her. She made a little English boy play for her. We will spend thy money there, or at the theater, or we will treat her to French wine or cognac in the Aurelius Garden, but the tickets we will not buy. What sayest thou? Yet, another mug of beer? And one and another successively having buried their blonde whiskers in the mawkish draught, curled them and swaggered off into the fair. The major, who had seen the key of number 90 put up on its hook, and had heard the conversation of the two young university bloods, was not at a loss to understand that their talk related to Becky. He little devil is at her old tricks, he thought, and he smiled as he recalled old days, when he had witnessed the desperate flirtation with Joe's, and the ludicrous end of that adventure. He and George had often laughed over it subsequently, and until a few weeks after George's marriage, when he also was caught in the little Circe's toils, and had an understanding with her which his comrade certainly suspected, but preferred to ignore. William was too much hurt or ashamed to ask to fathom that disgraceful mystery, although once, and evidently with remorse on his mind, George had alluded to it. It was on the morning of Waterloo, as the young men stood together in front of their line, surveying the black masses of Frenchmen who crowned the opposite heights, and as the rain was coming down, "I have been mixing in a foolish intrigue with a woman," George said. "I am glad we were marched away. If I drop, I hope Emmy will never know of that business. I wish to God it had never been begun." And William was pleased to think, and had more than once soothed poor George's widow with the narrative, that Osborne, after quitting his wife, and after the action of Quatre Bras, on the first day, spoke gravely and affectionately to his comrade of his father and his wife. On these facts too, William had insisted very strongly in his conversations with the elder Osborne, and had thus been the means of reconciling the old gentleman to his son's memory, just at the close of the elder man's life. "And so this devil is still going on with her intrigues," thought William. "Wish she were 100 miles from here. She brings mischief wherever she goes." And he was pursuing these forebodings, and this uncomfortable train of thought, with his head between his hands, and the Pumpernickel Gazette of last week unread under his nose, when somebody tapped his shoulder with a parasol, and he looked up and saw Mrs. Amelia. This woman had a way of tyrannizing over Major Dobbin, for the weakest of all people will domineer over somebody, and she ordered him about, and patted him, and made him fetch, and carry just as if he was a great Newfoundland dog. He liked, so to speak, to jump into the water, if she said, "I, Dobbin," and to trot behind her with her reticule in his mouth. This history has been written to very little purpose, if the reader has not perceived, that the Major was a spoony. "Why did you not wait for me, sir, to escort me downstairs?" she said, giving a little toss of her head and a most sarcastic curtsy. "I couldn't stand up in the passage," he answered with a comical deprecatory look, and, delighted to give her his arm, and to take her out of the horrid smoky place, he would have walked off without even so much as remembering the waiter, had not the young fellow run after him, and stopped him on the threshold of the Elephant, to make him pay for the beer which he had not consumed. Emmy laughed. She called him a naughty man, who wanted to run away in debt, and, in fact, made some jokes suitable to the occasion and the small beer. She was in high spirits and good humor, and tripped across the marketplace very briskly. She wanted to see Joe's that instant. The Major laughed at the impetuous affection Mrs. Amelia exhibited. For, in truth, it was not very often that she wanted her brother at instant. They found the civilian in his saloon on the first floor. He had been pacing the room, and biting his nails, and looking over the marketplace towards the Elephant 100 times at least during the past hour, while Stemmy was closeted with her friend in the garret, and the Major was beating the tattoo on the sloppy tables of the public room below, and he was, on his side too, very anxious to see Mrs. Osborne. "Well," said he, "the poor dear creature, how as he has suffered," Emmy said. "God bless my soul, yes," Joe said, wagging his head, so that his cheeks quivered like jellies. "She may have Payne's room, who can go upstairs," Emmy continued. Payne was a staid English maid, and personal attendant upon Mrs. Osborne, to whom the courier, as in duty bound, paid court, and whom Georgie used to arc dreadfully with accounts of German robbers and ghosts. She passed her time chiefly in grumbling, in ordering about her mistress, and in stating her intention to return the next morning to her native village of Clapham. "He may have Payne's room," Emmy said. Why, you don't mean to say you are going to have that woman into the house? Bounced out the major, jumping up.
Of course we are, said Amelia in the most innocent way in the world.
I'd be angry, and break the furniture, Major Dobbin.
Of course we are going to have her here.
Of course, my dear, Joe said.
The poor creature, after all her sufferings, Emmy continued. Her horrid banker broken and run away, her husband wicked wretch having deserted her, and taken her child away from her. Here she doubled her two little fists, and held them in a most menacing attitude before her, so that the major was charmed to see such a dauntless virago,
the poor dear thing.
Quite alone and absolutely forced to give lessons in singing to get her bread, and not have her here.
Take lessons, my dear Mrs. George, cried the major, but don't have her in the house.
I implore you don't.
Pooh, said Joes.
You who are always good, and kind always used to be at any rate I'm astonished at you, Major William, Amelia cried.
Hi, what is the moment to help her, but when she is so miserable?
Now is the time, to be of service to her.
The oldest friend I ever had, and not, she was not always your friend, Amelia, the major said, for he was quite angry.
This allusion was too much for Emmy, who, looking the major almost fiercely in the face, said,
for shame, Major Dobbin, and after having fired this shot, she walked out of the room with a most majestic air, and shut her own door briskly on herself and her outraged dignity.
To allude to that, she said,
when the door was closed.
H, it was cruel of him to remind me of it, and she looked up at George's picture, which hung there as usual, with the portrait of the boy underneath.
T was cruel of him. If I had forgiven it, ought he to have spoken?
No. And it is from his own lips, that I know how wicked and groundless my jealousy was, and that you were pure, oh, yes, you were pure, my saint in heaven.
She paced the room, trembling and indignant.
She went and leaned on the chest of drawers over which the picture hung, and gazed at it.
Its eyes seemed to look down on her with a reproach that deepened as she looked.
The early dear, dear memories of that brief prime of love rushed back upon her.
The wound which years had scarcely cicatrized bled afresh, and oh, how bitterly!
She could not bear the reproaches of the husband there before her.
It couldn't be.
Never, never.
Poor Dobbin, poor old William.
That unlucky word had undone the work of many a year, the long laborious edifice of a life of love.
Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.